And good afternoon, I almost said good morning. Oh my goodness, we're starting out so well. Welcome to Open Sources Guelph here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I am Adam A. Donaldson of Guelph Politico, and joining me is
Scotty Hertz. And weren't you up all night, like, tweeting the entire NDP in Ontario or something? So I got a text from Adam saying something.
Oh my goodness, I got that too, and I was like...
So it wasn't you then? I didn't think
it was
you.
No, it wasn't me.
No.
A lot of Adams out there.
Yeah. Adam the bot.
Adam bot, yeah.
Adam the bot texted us.
I am not Adam bot.
So just to clarify, it was not Adam Donaldson.
Stop sending me death threats.
Bothering you yesterday.
Open Sources is CFRU's political and current affairs discussion show, and you can listen to us live here on CFRU every Thursday at, well, today, 4:30 p.m. We're usually on at 5 p.m. You can also listen to us live online. Go to CFRU.ca and click on the Listen Now icon at the top right-hand corner of your screen, and you can listen to us anytime by downloading the Open Sources podcast on Podbean, iTunes, Stitcher, and the Google Play. Today, we will welcome Liberal candidate Sly Castaldi. We're going to the last two local provincial candidates who were willing to come in and have a sit down, pop by. Sly will be here at 5 o'clock, and then at 5:30, in lieu of not having a third candidate come in today, we're just going to have some general chit chat about how the election's been and where we think it's going to be going this last week. But at the top of the show, we are lucky enough to have with us Libertarian candidate Mike Reel here in studio with us. Michael, thank you for coming into Open Sources and joining us today.
Great, yeah. Thanks a lot for having me.
I feel like, maybe to get right into the politics discussion, I feel like the Libertarians haven't gotten much play in this election. And I know it's usually hard for your party to get media attention. But I feel like, with the PCs kind of going in a more libertarian bent themselves, and with the Ontario Party with a very libertarian voice, it feels like they're eating into the party's lunch a bit. It feels like, you know, maybe to be straight up libertarian and to wear the label proudly is a bit more difficult than in previous elections for you. But how do you feel about that?
Yeah, it's an interesting observation. I think that the PC party in some ways is definitely leaning a little bit more libertarian, as well as, you said, the Ontario party. Mm-hmm. But in terms of us as libertarians this year, we're running 117 candidates. So that represents 95% of the ridings, which is mm-hmm. the most that we've ever run, mm-hmm. Which we're really excited about. And we're getting a lot of exposure in terms of our core philosophy. And we have a platform that really, I think, exhibits the roots of our libertarianism. And we've been around since 1975, consistent message. And I think ultimately with a lot of the mistakes this PC party are making in this election, and the lessening of the impact the Ontario party has, they're not in nearly as many ridings as we are. Mm. I think it kind of gives us a little bit of an advantage or a benefit in terms of widening that exposure and getting some more people to kind of understand our message of liberty.
Yeah, and I did read that article, and I guess it was from a few weeks before the election where it was saying, like, well, you know, we are likely going to have a person running in every riding. I was like, no way, that can't be right. And that's no disrespect to you or the party, but I
mean, not at all.
It does seem like, you know, the idea of this election being one about change certainly has galvanized something in people who are looking, you know, beyond the three major parties. So, you know, when you're talking to fellow libertarians, what is driving them to, you know, to the party? What is driving that support, all that enthusiasm?
Well, our main message to our platform is explore new possibilities. Mm-hmm. And that's really what the Libertarian Party has embraced. They put a call out, I'd say, about a year ago, for volunteer candidates to try and run a full slate for the first year this election. And there was a large response within the party, and a lot of people put their hands up. And I think that's really due in part to all the parties have the same solution, the same message for the most part, especially when looking at the Liberals and the NDP. It's, you know, more money, little tweak, more funding, just give us the ability to run the program and we'll do it correctly. And a lot of people are getting tired of that message, and they see that it's not working, and they want to hear something different. So that's, I think, driving in large part the growth in terms of the number of candidates in our party.
Okay. Well, let's talk about you. Tell the people a bit about yourself and why you wanted to run as a libertarian.
Yeah, certainly. So, well, I was born in Cambridge and went to school around here, went to university in London, and have always been around the area and working in business and working often with smaller businesses is I've been in insurance and now in digital marketing and working with those smaller businesses. I was seeing a lot of challenges that they faced and increasingly so with the burdens placed upon them by the government. Mm-hmm. And I've always been fairly politically active myself. So just over the last couple of years, hearing very similar messages, I've become disillusioned with the main couple parties. Mm-hmm. And the Libertarian Party really aligned with my view of freedom for the individual and individual rights. And I wasn't hearing a lot of that, especially for the younger generation in this area. With a lot of the people that I spoke with, it was an opinion that wasn't often relayed. So I wanted to get out there and get that perspective more well-known.
So you mentioned small business there. I noticed I read a bit of your platform online and under the business section, some of the languages, there's some overlap with other parties, in particular, being a voice for the little guy. Mm-hmm. Now, in your view, or at least from what I understand it, you see it, or libertarians see it, that the government tends to interfere a lot in small business and business in general, I guess. What would it take? Like, what would your takeaway be in terms of how far out of the way government should get from business? Do you mean all the way? Is it like leave business alone to just sort of do as it will? What's the line that you would draw?
Good question. Great question. So there's a couple of different ways you can go about this question from a libertarian standpoint. In an ideological way, or in an ideological kind of ideal, libertarians say the only way that the government should step in is if a corporation is instigating aggression or violence or fraud upon an individual. Of course, in the way that our current government is set up, you know, that's an end goal that might not ever be achieved. Mm-hmm. So the goal is really to move to a smaller, more community-based governments that take into consideration the needs of the local citizens and their needs, as opposed to a large centralized government dictating regulations and picking and choosing winners when it comes to corporations. So ultimately, libertarians would try to remove as many regulations from the provincial government and try and give more responsibility to municipal and community governments to regulate corporations and businesses in their communities.
So something like the feds buying Kinder Morgan this week, you'd be like, no way, don't ever do that.
Correct.
Okay.
Exactly. Yeah. That's exactly.
Don't do that.
That is libertarians are not a fan of.
Right.
That.
Yeah.
Yes.
I was wondering about the philosophy of that too, though, because one of the things I think I've taken note of in the election is that a lot of people are actually looking for more help from the government, whether that's, you know, something like pharmacare, dental care, more health care, more education. It seems like it's a bit of an uphill climb to say, you know, the province seems to be in its way wanting to get more help from the government versus saying, well, you know what, maybe the government isn't the solution to these problems, even though.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's not necessarily a black and white issue. And the libertarians aren't saying end all public services, of course. What we want to do is basically bring more choice into the equation. Mm-hmm. So we're saying open up some non-government options that can compete on a fair, non-biased basis with government options and let individuals choose how their tax dollars are spent. Mm-hmm. So, for instance, in terms of education, we would attach funding to the individual and allow parents to choose how that funding is applied to their child's education. If that's a government school, they can choose to spend it in a public school. If it's private, they can choose that. In terms of healthcare, the same thing. Insurance options are open. People can choose to use OHIP, or they could choose to use a more specialized plan that may have different options based on different individual needs. Mm-hmm. Similar to institutions, there would still obviously have to be some funding for some emergency and necessary care, but for in large part funding towards the individual to bring competition into the equation to foster more development, which we ultimately think will reduce costs and improve the quality of care and service and education, so that down the road, people don't have to rely as much on government. They do have other options. Mm-hmm. Now, it's obviously not a quick fix, mm-hmm. but it's something that we think by bringing more competition into it, we can make steps towards improving that and reducing the reliance that citizens have on the government provided services.
I think the difficulty I have is that for a lot of people, you know, love it or leave it, the government is the only one they can rely on. That, you know, there is a society out there, or there, you know, segments of our society that, you know, you can say, you know, we want to give more people options, but it does strike me that choice is there's an element of privilege to choice too. That, you know, what you propose and what the party mm-hmm. proposes, you know, would leave a lot of people behind.
Now, I don't necessarily look at it that way in mm-hmm. terms of we would keep a lot of the public services available, and it would be, you know, obviously baby steps and small steps towards the ultimate goal of reducing that reliance on government.
Mm-hmm.
We would want to open the door to more smaller and community-based organizations to pick up some of that, the slack that some of these government-provided services don't provide.
Mm-hmm.
And to libertarians, you know, we look at a lot of these services that are created by the government, and it's a one-size-fits-all program
mm-hmm.
That often don't meet the needs of the individual. So we want to promote the development of more smaller community-based organizations that can provide some of these same services, but just more specific to the local need, to the individuals who actually use that service in the community.
Mm-hmm.
Not necessarily taking away a lot of those things, but providing other options. You know, poverty has been around for 50 years, and there's been, you know, the government's implemented how many programs to try and mm-hmm. try and solve it, and it's still with us.
Mm-hmm.
So as libertarians, we think competition, more choice, will ultimately reduce the costs and open the market, increase access to more people.
Mm-hmm. I forgot where I was going to go with this next, but what I'll say is, you know, I think there's a lot of agreement that, you know, there are a lot of regulations, and sometimes it can come across as silly. And I talked to somebody, you know, years ago, I was in conversation with somebody who's talking about being a manager of a local establishment. He had 21 people sort of working that day, and a health inspector came in, and there was some element of training where if you had 21 people on the premise, or more than 20 people on the premise, you needed to do something, some regulation. So he just told the one guy to go home. And you know, that story always sticks with me when we're talking about government regulations, because there has to be some way we can, you know, create a society where we have, you know, set regulations, but in terms, like, be flexible. Like, what's the difference between 20 and 21?
Exactly. You know, yes. And that's why we advocate for that return to smaller community governments. You know, that was probably, there was an issue that was brought to the court where someone got hurt because
right.
they could only account for 20 people. And then the provincial government said, well, you need to have this training. And that just applies to everyone, regardless of
mm-hmm.
situation and work, that sort of a thing. So libertarians ultimately, you know, we obviously know that there has to be a central governing force to adjudicate certain things. But that should be on a smaller community
mm-hmm.
or municipal basis.
Would that be, it's funny talking about smaller, more local government, because the PC candidate here has been talking a lot of, let's call it smack, about Wellington County, that, you know, that it's kind of getting in the way. It's getting in between opportunity and Guelph, or opportunity from the government and Guelph. But it seems like that's sort of more the model you're talking about is, you know, there should be more authority with the city, yes, but also with, you know, Wellington County, you know, that's where the more flexibility and the more authority should be is with the closer to whatever you're living. That should be the, you know, the main point of
exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. You're closer to the people, you're talking to them every day, you know what they need, what they want, and you're more able to respond to it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Let me ask you about specifically, you know, regulations and how far regulations go, because I think, you know, governments enact regulations for the idea of safety. And, you know, as we've kind of seen in the last 10 years or so, sometimes no matter how well regulated or how many regulations there are in industries, you know, you have private companies that can still be bad actors. And I'm thinking about, you know, primarily if you look at, you know, the housing industry in the United States and banking, you know, these are companies that didn't enjoy a lot of regulation to begin with. And I'm wondering your point of view. It's like, how can we enjoy a world, I guess, of fewer regulations when we can't entirely trust, you know, and maybe this gets to the question of size, too, that, you know, we have big corporations, and in so much as we like to blame government for being too unwieldy to be able to adjust and, you know, what's good for Guelph, not necessarily good for Thunder, not necessarily good for North Bay, but perhaps there's a comparative there for corporations that, you know, what's going on in one arm of the corporation doesn't necessarily know what the other arm of the corporation is doing.
For sure. And when you talk about, you know, like housing and banking in the States, a lot of that is kind of crony capitalism and taking mm-hmm. advantage of big government and getting advantages based off of grants and subsidies and bailouts and mm-hmm. kind of, you know, turning a blind eye to certain things. Mm-hmm. And obviously libertarians are not for that at all. We're for equal treatment for everyone, you know, small business to large business. It's not the government's job to pick or choose winners, right? We want to open it up to the free market. And basically the government's job is unless an individual comes forward with a problem based off of, you know, some infraction of aggression or fraud, then the government should basically stay hands off.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Is there an element of idealism to that, though? Like, in so much as you have, like, people on the communist side who are like, let's, you know, 32-hour work week, 20-hour
minimum wage.
$20 minimum wage, you know. It seems to me that, you know, a lot of the libertarian platform is very much idealism, that we're expecting people to be their very best, and that's not always the case, even in business.
Yeah, again, a good observation. And libertarian at its core is a very ideological political stance. You know, mm-hmm. we do believe in personal responsibility, the non-aggression principle, but we know in a realistic, reasonable way that if we are to make steps in Ontario and with the Canadian Libertarian Party as well, it's more about bringing a different perspective and a different point of view to the conversation. We know that we're not going to immediately enact a utopian libertarian world, but it's about having a different conversation than adding this program or adding this funding to this. We want to open the door to more choice, more opportunity, more competition mm-hmm. to ultimately try and move away from big government. But you are right in that a lot of, at its core, it is very ideological, in that we do believe in the rights of the individual to act as they'd like, as long as they're not infringing upon anyone else.
Well, let's put some of that in motion then. I think one of the areas that we can look at is housing. I know that Green Leader Mike Schreiner has talked a lot about we need to singing the libertarian song, but you know, taking away regulations in order to get more varieties of housing. Mm-hmm. So, can you talk a little bit about the libertarian platform for housing?
For sure. So, basically, the problem is demand. You know, the demand's mm-hmm. much higher than the supply, and the artificially raised prices. You know, we need to remove the regulations to allow those new units to be built by private investors to fill that gap. You know, it's great to live in a fantasy land where everyone deserves a standard of living determined by the government, but it's ultimately not a reality for everyone. Mm-hmm. And we need to embrace that reality and understand it, that not everyone can afford to live in what the government deems a standard of living for everyone.
Right.
So like you said, with the Green Party, kind of removing a lot of those regulations to have different types and creative units, especially in, you know, our ever growing urban centers, to allow some people who are in need of it mm-hmm. to have, you know, at the very least some shelter, a place to live.
Mm-hmm.
So I just want to talk in the bigger scheme of things. Mm-hmm. I was in the UK probably around the time, the tail end of the Thatcher years, when deregulation hit there pretty hard. Buses, transportation deregulated, phones deregulated, and there was like, it was weird in that there was like four types of payphone at one point, you know, half of them busted. There was, the train system was a bit chaotic. They're still sort of sorting through that. In terms of your transition to, it sounds like transitioning to just a complete free market in everything. Is a bit chaotic. Is there mm-hmm. anything that you see in terms of that chaos, sort of mitigating that chaos? Or is that part of what will happen if you say, okay, no more? Well, we've done it with phones here. Mm. And phones are deregulated. Certain things are deregulated. But for example, transportation, it's like, okay, we deregulate Guelph Transit tomorrow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And is it, we got Johnny's bus line and we got the school bus people maybe wanting to do it and it's a bit whatever. Is there any way to ease into that, or is it basically going to be, you know, there's going to be this period where it's like laissez-faire all over the place. Mm-hmm. Nobody knows what bus to take.
Really interesting question. Yeah. We think that there is a little bit of a way to ease into that by allowing it to allowing private non-government options to cohabitate with government programs, so that for a transition period, you still have the government public services to rely on if necessary, but these competing interests can potentially prove their benefit. And there will still be, obviously, a time period where there may be a couple of options, but you know, choice is not necessarily a bad thing. There's a lot of areas where choice breeds innovation, breeds development, and we do feel like a time period where there are people with who do have that choice and are making their choice with their dollars, that will be a benefit to society in the end.
You know, it makes me think of what we're seeing right now in regional transportation, because we have Metrolinx, which is expanding or trying to get two-day all-way. All day, two-way.
Everyone does that.
Trying.
Yeah.
Yes.
Trying is the key word. But everyone, because it's an election, everyone's promising it'll be here tomorrow. But, you know, that's neither here nor there. But, you know, we also have a private transportation service in the form of Greyhound, which has been cutting back service. And, I mean, I guess this goes back to one of my original questions, which is about, you know, people are looking for the government to do no more. So, I mean, how do we appeal to, like, the Greyhounds of the world that are, you know, how do we get them, I guess, I don't want to say more social, but, you know, how do we get them to sort of take on that additional responsibility and not recede? You know, it seems to me like there's opportunities to expand, but it's, you know, they're doing what's in their business interest, of course, but.
For sure. And that's, you know, there could be multiple reasons for that, you know, with rising costs of, for example, gas. You know, mm-hmm. I've ridden Greyhound a number of times, and I'm sure they've got a number of new buses and stuff, but oftentimes the buses are a little bit older and, mm-hmm. and potentially maintenance is getting a little bit more expensive. Who knows what the specific reasons are? But I do know that there is an opportunity for more private transportation to be introduced into the market. And I think one of the ways to at least entice more of that is to make, you know, job markets like Guelph more attractive to smaller businesses, mm-hmm. have more people coming to Guelph from Toronto, for example, to get two-way. You know, you need to have two-way traffic
right.
at all times of the day.
Mm-hmm.
So you know, it's a large question and it's a large problem to solve in that there's a lot of different things that are affecting it. But I think by reducing the regulations, number one, on business and number two, on transit and the ability to start a private company and the different regulations needed to do so, mm-hmm. can entice growth in private transportation services. Like, just look at Uber, for example. It's right. been growing like crazy.
Mm-hmm.
It's private transportation company. It's faced some regulation issues, but ultimately it's been overcoming those and it's growing
right.
fairly steadily.
Right. There's an element to this, though, that maybe it takes, you know, business savvy politicians who understand both sides of the equation. But I was having a conversation with somebody who worked in the Home Builders Association here, and they were saying, you know, there are a lot of home builders, and, you know, home building's a big business in Guelph, and there are a lot of opportunities for young people to work. They just have to be trained, you know, start on as apprentices. There's colleges and post-secondary institutions right up the road in Kitchener that can give them that training. But, you know, these are young people who have, you know, grown up with in a society where driving isn't the priority. It's not, you know, pro forma to get your license when you're 16 anymore. It just seems like and this hit me because it's like I want transit, you know, because I don't drive. I want to get around. But these business people want more transit, you know, so they can have an easier time recruiting people and getting them trained and getting into business. And so it seems like we all want the same thing. How do mm-hmm. we all get on the same page to make a case?
Exactly. No, exactly. And and that's also where us as libertarians are bringing our perspective to the table. You know, we want the same thing as everyone: a better society, a more efficient, effective, better results for everyone, more services available to more people. But when you talk about specifically, you know, like training and skills and these, you know, builders looking for people who aren't necessarily trained, again, I think it comes down to a lack of choice for a lot of students and young people, and a lot of regulation that's placed upon them. You know, mandatory registration with the Ontario College of Trades, for example. You can't just no longer just go out and get a job and start working as a tradesperson. So that's why, you know, we would advocate more non-government options and more involvement of private industry to kind of direct the type of training so that young people, when they're coming out of these post-secondary and college and training courses, they have the skills that the workforce is kind of expecting of them and the competencies that they're looking for.
Okay. We do ask all the candidates to come in this question, but what is an issue you think that you are concerned might be overlooked in the campaign? Something in particular that we haven't talked about or you don't hear talked about because.
Well, it's not necessarily something that's not talked about, but I would say it's something that's overlooked. You know, the conversation around minimum wage and young workers, the main parties all talk about what they'll do to raise minimum wage to increase the income of young workers. What I think is really overlooked is the impact that a raise on minimum wage has on those young workers, inexperienced workers, and low-skilled workers. It's really pricing any labor out of the market that's worth less than $15 per hour. And I really think there's a conversation that's being missed around encouraging businesses to invest in automation and cutting costs as opposed to investing in training, building programs that build experience for young workers and inexperienced workers. And I think raising a minimum wage puts that incentive towards automation as opposed to reducing that burden on businesses, allowing them to freely enter into employee-employer relationships without being infringed upon by the government, and providing young workers with opportunities to gain experience, which I think is being severely limited and will be more and more so down the road if this kind of trend of pandering to increasing the minimum wage for political reasons continues.
I'm not sure. I mean, I would argue that the Wynn government did it for political reasons.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, being someone who earns a minimum wage in their day job, my quality of life has increased.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, we could probably talk about this for hours, my point of view is that, like, the stores of the world, the Loblaws and the Shoppers Drug Mart, they don't need the incentive of the $15 minimum wage to install robot checkouts.
That's true.
That's going to happen no matter how much you pay a cashier.
That's true. But also the raise in minimum wage will be transferred over to the customers and an increase in the cost of living down the road. So ultimately, it's about having a bigger conversation about the impact. It's not just a value add policy, basically.
Fair enough. Mm-hmm. Well, if people want to learn more about the Libertarian platform and your campaign, where can people find that information?
For sure. So we're online at libertarian.on.ca. You can find our platform and information about our party leader and some of our recent newsletters and media releases, that sort of a thing.
All right. Well, Mike Real, we appreciate you coming in, and we had a good chat. May not agree on everything, but we like having good chats here.
Awesome. Thanks.
So thanks, and good luck on the campaign trail, and we'll see what happens on, I guess, a week from today.
Great. Well, thanks a lot, Adam. Thanks, Scotty. Great. It's a pleasure being on.
All right. Well, thank you. And we are going to take a quick break and come right back with Liberal candidate Sly Castaldi. You are listening to Open Source as Guelph here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio.
We might not even sing the same song, but we all start out with the hope of a brighter day. Start out perfect. It's what they say. We'll all go to heaven one fine day. We'll end up wrapping the arms of the ones we love. I hope you're happy. I hope you're strong. Pray that no one ever treats you wrong. Hope you learn to see with the love in your heart. In your heart. You know what's in your heart. In your heart. Man, it's in your heart. In your heart. You know it's in your heart. In your heart. Yes, it's in
what's in your heart.
And that was Manitoba Howl. Brand new album, Blues is in the Water. Manitoba Howl is obviously from Manitoba. No, he's actually from Nova Scotia. What the heck? Who knows? Anyway, nice
That's
little
false
album.
Advertising.
New to the station.
You can't, you can't call yourself Manitoba and be from Nova Scotia.
He has lots of guitars, I'll say.
That has to be in the charter.
And ukulele. Yeah, that's right. Who knows? Anyway, we'll be hearing more of that probably in the future.
It's got banjo, so we have to play
that for Rockside, yeah.
Shout out to Rockside, who loves those banjos. Anyway, we are pleased to welcome in the studio Liberal candidate Sly Castaldi. And Sly, it's been a busy day for you, but we're glad that you made time for us. So thank you for dropping by.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Let's start by talking about, you've been talking a lot in this race about, the reasons why you wanted to run. So yeah. I guess we'll ask you to do it one more time. But, you know, how have you made the transfer? Well, let's start at the before that. You know, how did you get into being, an advocate for violence against women? And how did you end up at Women in Crisis? And, I mean, that's been your world for not to make you sound old or anything, but it's, you know.
Thank you.
That's been your life story, though, it is a big transition you're undertaking.
Yeah, it's interesting. When I was first hired at Women in Crisis, I was hired as a frontline staff. So I worked at, in those days, it was called General Welfare during the week. And then on the weekends, I had this job at Women in Crisis, and I was answering the crisis line and working with women at the shelter. And it was during that time that I started to see how I was actually helping women who were in the shelter. And the job at Welfare, I loved the people and I loved the opportunity to work there. But I wasn't really feeling like I was doing real good, like social work. And so a job came open at Women in Crisis, and I applied for it. And I got hired to be in the sexual assault program. And you know those moments where you hit your stride, you find your wheelhouse, however you want to say it. It just became an incredible passion for me, fighting for women's rights, and especially women who have experienced sexual violence, because it's a topic that nobody in the world wants to talk about. Mm. So picture this: in the early 90s, there was no hashtag Me Too. There were no big campaigns to bring awareness. Nobody believed survivors. The agency was seen as a radical feminist edge that didn't get a lot of support. And so it was a really, really, it was a tough thing to try to get people to pay attention. But the more I did the work, and I fell in love with doing anti-violence against women work. And I became the assistant executive director. And then in 2000, and I think it was 3 or 4, I've lost track now, because I have been with Women in Crisis for 28 years. Wow. So at some point during that time, the job of executive director came up, and I applied for it, and I took the helm. And during my time as ED, I was able to grow the organization, and now we currently also do human trafficking work. We have a family court support program, and we just kept growing and growing because the need is always there. And people are always surprised. They think that Guelph is this tiny little community that's got no issues, right? And so, and in large part, some of that is because we've always kept our shelter confidential. So we've always hidden in plain sight. But it occurred to me one morning while I was in the shower thinking, you know, it was our 40th anniversary. We got to do something different. And we decided to go public with the shelter, because it was like, how do you build community support if you keep the community so outside of this issue? And so we decided, nope, this is an issue. Violence against women is an issue. The community needs to be a part of the solution, and we need to invite them to be a part of it. And so we just recently went public this past year, so that was kind of a big deal. But it is my life's work. It's my passion. I've always felt it was like a calling.
Let me phrase it this way then. You know, making the transition to a politician, is that because you've maybe done all you can do on the hands-on level, or is that because coming from that hands-on experience, you know where it has to be taken next from the government level, and perhaps it's more easier to do than to you know, at carry on with your, what you've been doing the last few years, which is to be a part of the advisory council.
Yeah. So it's a great question because, you know, you can imagine that when they approached me to run, it really ruined my Christmas holidays because I was because I was thinking about it, and I tend to overthink, and I was thinking and thinking and thinking, and I thought, my God, do I really want to be a politician? Is this what I need to do? But, you know, I spoke to everybody in my life, my family, my friends, my colleagues, and it was interesting. Everybody said, do it. Try it. You need to try and see if you can take your advocacy and your community building and your work to a whole different level. Shift the way politics is done from you're a community advocate, you have a community perspective, take it to another level. So I kind of felt like I jumped off a cliff, and people say, you know what, it's the only way to see if you can actually fly, right? So the past 3 years while I've been at Queen's Park as the Premier's co-chair on violence against women, which was a huge honor and a tremendous amount of work, but I saw change happen faster than I've ever seen anything. So if you take 28 years of knocking on doors and advocating and fighting with government and trying to push them to do good public policy and violence against women, and then being a co-chair of this roundtable, and I saw all the legislation that we were able to pass and all the work that we were able to do, just having that kind of access was mind-blowing to me, right? And so I thought, oh, this is maybe, you know, all roads lead somewhere, right? And maybe this is my personal crossroads around, you know what, take it and see. Try and see what you can do now. And only you can tell, right? Take your skills and your abilities and all your experiences and see if you can take it up a notch. And I would also say, though, it's not that I have done everything that I cannot wait, because I'm always full of new ideas. I want to build a new shelter in the county, because women who live in our county still have to travel an hour any direction. But women who live in Guelph can go to Kitchener or to Milton or to Guelph, have more access to services. So that was always part of in my strat plan, you know, of things I still need to do. And I didn't see it as an either or. I saw it as, there's a moment in time I've been asked to step up, and it's been one of the most challenging things I have ever done. So, yeah.
I was going to ask that. You know, I was at Three Willows the other night, and one of the things you did, I know why you're laughing, but one of the things that you said during your comments is you thanked people.
Yes.
And not just your people, but you thanked everyone who was running and everyone who was supporting them to run.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering, how has it been? Because you, having worked with politicians on your issues from the advocacy side, but how do you understand the process now that you've been on the other side and you've been the one doing the campaigning versus the one who's advocating to the campaigners?
So, you know, what the thing that surprised me the most about this entire experience is that I thought I was somebody who was fairly in the know, you know, like I'm totally connected, I'm doing all this kind of stuff. And then I walked into this world where I saw so many dedicated volunteers who actually volunteer for political parties, for associations, for all of them, right? And they're out there every day canvassing. They're out there every day doing literature drops. They're knocking on doors. They're putting up signs. And, you know, and I thought we had the best volunteers at Women in Crisis. Like, I sing their praises all the time. And then I see all of these other volunteers in this whole new world of people who are committed to their communities, committed to their political associations or to the party of their choice, and they are phenomenal people. Like, and you know, and everybody says to me that Guelph is a, like the different campaign managers and everybody who's involved and stuff, they say Guelph is a very interesting place because we're an informed community, we're an engaged community, we know what's going on, and we've got this infrastructure of these dedicated volunteers. And It actually makes me feel really good about democracy and the political process, because everybody wants to say that everything sucks and nobody loves, you know, nobody trusts politicians and all that kind of stuff. And here I see all of these people who are actually wanting to do good, right? Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, everybody's working for the different campaigns, but from my perspective, I think it's phenomenal. I'm grateful for them. And I think actually these are the future leaders of tomorrow, which is really good. So I want them to have positive experiences. I want them to be thanked every day. I want them to feel appreciated for the work that they're doing, because that's who's going to take over. You know, they say that leadership is not about creating followers, but creating more leaders. Mm. And I think that that's been the really wonderful surprise that I've experienced through this. It's been a transition and it's been a learning curve. I mean, trying to learn your platform, everybody's platform, and this and that and the other stuff, that's like heavy, heavy stuff. And, you know, I don't always find that the debates are the best way to sort of engage in real meaningful dialogue. I engage more at the door with people than I get people at the door and they start asking me questions and then we can have a really good conversation. But asking you to talk about a real big issue and answer in a minute is like close to impossible.
Yeah.
Without sort of just spewing party platform. And I don't think that that's actually very meaningful. Mm-hmm. You know, so I always want to encourage people, check out the platforms, but call the candidates. Go meet. I got people who drop into my office all the time and say, I want to meet with you and I want to talk to you about this, or I saw that debate and can you answer a little bit more about that, or what were you meaning about that? And I think that that's where you get in better, more meaningful dialogue.
How many of them are looking for bagels though? And they just didn't know that.
Yeah, we have granola bars.
Oh, all right. See, right?
So that's what we have. So if you're looking for bagels, it's not us.
Yeah.
So yesterday, it sounds like it was an interesting, you've been going to a lot of events and whatnot, but yesterday there was one that interested me was the meeting at Hope House, the campaign community breakfast.
Yeah, yeah.
And it sounded like they took each of the candidates and seated you with a table and maybe with people, maybe not necessarily you, but other candidates who are associating with people they wouldn't necessarily associate with.
Yes.
And probably a bit of an eye-opener too. So in terms of that, and I'm sure there was a good learning experience for everybody that was there. In terms of, let's get down to brass tacks on liberal policy then, in terms of poverty and homelessness, how do you see, the kind of situation like Hope House relating directly to liberal policy? What is the plan to, in terms of alleviation or programs that may help with that, which is a massive issue in this town that I don't think gets enough attention.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, for sure. And I think that, we have a housing strategy and a homelessness strategy that I think, I want to be clear with people. It requires all three levels of government to work together. And I think that sometimes that hasn't happened as well in the past. So I'd like to be able to bring my connections with all levels of government to figure out how to make things better for Guelph. But not one solution is actually going to deal with homelessness. I do believe that for Hope House, though, the thing that was most important was the basic income pilot project that's going on. Mm-hmm. I think that that is going to, it's showing that it's actually improving people's lives. And so now the question becomes, okay, if this is actually a better strategy, how do we pay for it and how do we roll it out, Ontario-wide? Because I think one of the things that's really, really hard, and I think each party can promise everything, but when I'm at the door, I hear two things. One is, you guys are spending like drunken sailors. You're going into debt left, right, and center, blah, 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 right? And then I hear the opposite reaction of you're not doing enough, right? And I think every party has to grapple with, we want a social safety network that works. And I believe that this basic income pilot is showing such really good results. The question becomes, how are we going to pay for it, right? And so how do you do both? How do you become fiscally responsible and provide support and opportunity to people who have been left out of that typically throughout all sorts of governments? And I mean, I believe in the liberal platform mostly because when I was younger, I used to think in extremes, you know, it's this or nothing. This is, you end violence against women now. And as I have grown into my job, my profession, my career, I actually understand that for every voice that's over here, there's another voice over here. And so my job is always trying to find those places in the middle that we can actually move forward with. And so, you know, the expression, sometimes you need to find low-hanging fruit and then with longer-term goals. And so that's what I try to do. And I think that's what our platform tries to do. It's been trying to take into account that not everybody gets to enjoying the prosperity. And so how do you bring in other folks who have been marginalized and left behind, and also in a way that we can pay for it?
I did want to ask you about the mushy middle, because
middle? Yeah. Can you say it differently, please?
All right. I guess the collision point, because I think there are probably a lot of people out there that have enjoyed the dedication to equality that Kathleen Wynne and the Liberals have brought. Like the things like the new sex ed curriculum, which does... you know, take into account things like harassment and consent, equal pay, you know, strong stance about violence against women. But, you know, people then look at their hydro bills or they see how much childcare is or how much it is to send their kid to Ontario University. So I'm just wondering, you know, how do we sort of thread that needle, or how do you thread that needle when you're talking to people at the door? Because, you know, you're also addressing, you know, people are looking for government to do more. And we were talking about that with Mike Real, that, you know, the Libertarian platform is, of course, like smaller government. But what a lot of people are saying is, you know, we need government to pick up more of the slack. So it's, I mean, that's a lot to keep in mind. And I'm not sure exactly where the question is, but, you know, in terms of, you know, that's why I called it the mushy middle.
Yeah, and so I just want to say right off the bat that I want to go on the record, and I've been saying this like a broken record, but there is no government in the history of the province of Ontario that has done more for women and women's equality rights and violence against women than Premier Wynne. And she deserves major, major kudos for this, because I have been doing this work for almost 30 years. And I can tell you, I've seen it all. And she has gone the distance on this. And the stuff that has happened and what we have because of it, I think the woman deserves like a medal for it, honestly. And not just because she's my premier and my leader, but having been in that work, I can tell you without you know, without exaggeration, that no one has even come close to what she's done. So I get that, and that's hugely important for me. But I think that what she has found a way through her platform. You guys looking at each other because the time is kind of okay.
That's what we do. It's all this darting around.
I think what she's found in her platform is she understands that people have said, "Hey, you know, not everybody's enjoying the prosperous times in Ontario." And so she has found a way to say, okay, what's most important? What gives us the most bang? I'll find another phrase for that. But what has the most impact?
Most return on investment.
Most return on investment. Yeah. We all know that if you want to try to alleviate poverty, education is a way through it. So that's with the free tuition for people who would never have access to it. And to date, I think there's 235,000 people who have taken advantage of that. That's huge, right? And I do believe that education is one way out of poverty. I think raising the minimum wage, like, she took a political hit for that, right? Like, I think people were really upset about it, but she did it, you know? And there's even people who said, but you should have gone right to 15 right away. And there are others who are saying equally, why didn't you phase it in a dollar every year, right? Yeah. So governing and government, in my mind, is supposed to do and make those decisions that we can't make for ourselves, nor would we if left to our own devices, right? Because I think people think that, you know, you're destroying small business, you're doing this, you're doing that. But you know what? How else are people? If you work full time, you should be able to pay your rent, feed your family, and enjoy life a bit, right? Like, and so that's the fairness and the stuff that kind of appeals to me. It's kind of like that's what this is supposed to be about, right? Taking those bigger issues and finding out how to move that needle forward. Because you can promise the sun and the moon and the sky, and if you don't have to deliver it, then whatever. you know, out of all the candidates, I'm the only one who has to account for 15 years of policy. And it, you know, and that's my own burden. It like it feels like I've got an extra, a bit of a more of a cross to bear.
Mm.
But I believe that what she has done as premier has been effective. And like, look, we have low unemployment. You know, we're leading all the G7 countries in economic growth. Mm-hmm. We've got the lowest corporate rate, and yet everybody wants to pretend like the sky is falling, right? And which really confuses me. And so this narrative that's been created and against Wynn has actually, you know, worked in a really negative way. But yet the province isn't doing badly, and I think that's so unfair. Like, if she were a CEO, she would have hit her marks,
right?
And she would have been, nobody would have been saying, well, it's time for a change, you're doing a great job.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, it's hard to,
right.
It's hard to reconcile that in my head. It's also hard to fight at the door, but I do my best to try to offer a different narrative.
Right. I hear what you're saying, but I think it's almost a similar story to what happened in the United States a couple of years ago, where there was all the positive economic numbers were in the Democrats' favor for the Democrat nominee. But, you know, there are places where, you know, people aren't necessarily feeling the positive effects, too.
Yeah. So I think that's what she was trying to do, especially in the most recent budget, around, you know, the free the drugs, pharmacare for those who are under 25 for sure, and then next plan is the seniors. So those are the kind of things. Like, you can't do everything at once. Sure, if we could open it all up and say, everybody take what you need, and we'll all move on, that would be great. But that's not how it works. So you have to make hard decisions. And where is it going to have the biggest impact? And for me, I think the decisions that she's been making, I'm distracted by squirrel.
Yeah.
I think the decisions that she's been making are having really good impacts. And so, it's good. But I totally take the point.
Right.
Yeah, there are people who are still feeling disenfranchised, and there are people who are still feeling, you're doing way too much, you know, and you need to do more for only business and only this and only that.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, the interesting thing is everybody's got an agenda. Mm-hmm. Everybody has their own agenda. And I think the role of government is to take all those agendas and try and figure out how to formulate a plan that will be good for the province as a whole.
Let me ask you about...
Oh, sorry, I kicked you. I'm sorry.
No one saw it. It's okay. No one saw a thing.
And I just announced it out loud. That's great. Yes. I forget we're live.
Well, I think this interview is over.
Yeah.
But I wanted to ask you about the current MPP and who you hope to replace, Liz Sandals. I would have asked this of all the candidates, but I can only imagine their answers. But, you know, speaking as someone who is looking to succeed Liz Sandals as a Liberal MPP for Guelph, you know, what do you think her legacy in terms of representing Guelph has been?
Well, Liz is I think of her as a stateswoman, because she's been in politics for such a long time at the provincial level, and then being a trustee, and then, you know, being president of the Federation and all that kind of stuff. Like, I think she's a phenomenal woman. And the really wonderful part about this process is I've been getting to spend a lot of time with her, and she's been teaching me, essentially, and mentoring me. And I am grateful for it. Liz has brought in a lot of money into this community, and I'm sure most people would know it, but she's built 12 schools, you know, in her time. You know, she's been able to, she's gotten buildings for lots of agencies, you know. She's been able to advocate for increased services. She has, she's put in a lot of infrastructure money into the city of Guelph, and she's fought hard for us and represented us really, really well. And she's done an amazing job. I appreciate her now, because I've always appreciated, but I think that she is an incredible woman. She's really, really smart. She knows the issues really, really well. And however this thing turns out, I would I would hope that whoever is lucky enough to replace her, that they would connect with her and use her counsel, because she is really, really wise and she knows so much. I always think of her as the grandmother of education. And so she's people should utilize that expertise, because we're lucky enough to have it. And she knows how things work, and she knows how to help people, and she knows government. So, yeah.
She's taken us to school a few times.
Yes, I'm sure. Yeah. I really appreciate her. I think she's a lovely, lovely woman, and I care for her, and I'm quite fond of her.
Well, in wrapping up, sadly, we are almost out of time. But you
this
know,
has been fun.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, we come
see,
back.
And you were
you
nervous
should,
coming in.
I know I was. You should come. Yeah. I'll come
you're
back.
On our list now, so you're
you.
On the short
yay,
list.
Yay.
What do you think, or what are you worried that is going to be like an overlooked issue that, you know, people going into the voting booth then maybe thinking about that hasn't gotten a lot of air in this campaign?
You know, to be honest, guys, the thing I'm most worried about is that there's such a negative narrative story about Kathleen Wynne. I think it's undeserved. I think that it's had an impact. And you know what was interesting? If you guys watch the debate, the fact that she had to apologize that people don't like her, it's only because she's a woman that she had to do that, right? Because as a woman, you're supposed to be, everybody's supposed to like you. The woman is smart. She's done a good job for this province. She's done a good, and nobody's perfect, right? But she's always, in my mind, I've watched her in the debate, she's remained premiership, if that's a word, you know, like as opposed to presidential-ish or whatever. But she
make it a word.
She remains always true to her values, and she's ethical, and she's kind, and she's smart. And I think that's the part. And this whole, you know, you guys have been going to government for 15 years. I think that's a hard thing to try and
counteract,
you know. So yeah, it is. I never realized how hard it was coming into it, but it's hard. But I think she has done an incredible job, and I think the story about her is undeserved.
Well, Sly, we thank you so much for your time. If people want to learn more about you and the Liberal campaign, where can they get that information?
We're at the where the former With the Grain was. That's our office. And
good
so,
spot.
Yeah.
Good spot.
So come on down, and I'm happy to talk to everybody who, just come say hello.
No bagels, though. Granola bars, no bagels.
Granola bars, yes.
Granola's good.
All right. Well, Sly, again, thank you so much for coming in, and good luck in the last week of campaigning. We'll see how it goes.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. And we are going to take a break, and we're going to do some old-fashioned punditry because, you know, someone didn't come in anyway.
We have a seat to fill or something.
Yeah, we got some time to fill. You're listening to Open Sources Guelph here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio.
You Gen Xers out there were singing along with that one, because I think you know it. The Lemonheads from 1992. The album and the song, because that was the title track, are called It's a Shame About Ray.
Oh, dear.
Funny how something 25 plus years old could be so applicable to recent events the past, let's call it, past 48 hours in Guelph.
Oh, dear.
Which you ended up somewhat embroiled in. Tell us the story, Adam. It went from this all candidates debate up the road to going pretty much national, or at least provincial, on Press Progress.
Yeah.
And they name-checked Guelph Politico in the middle of
all
that.
They did name-check Guelph Politico, which was nice.
Guelph's top news source for politics.
Not according to CJoy. They're the Guelph's news leader.
Oh.
You know what? First of all, let me toot my horn a bit, because I don't usually do that. You know, Guelph Politico like at least every 6 months or so does break news. And this was
I opened the window there, jump through it.
Well, I think the last time I broke news was back with when Scientology was moving into Forty Baker. Yeah, I broke that story. Not Guelph Today or Guelph Tribune. I did. I had my story up like a week before theirs.
Okay.
Now that I've done that. So I go up to Three Willows, which is at the top of the hill at Willow Road, on your way down to Imperial.
And it's kind of your neighborhood, sort of, right?
It is my neighborhood. In the vicinity. Sure. I mean, yeah. Sure, it's my neighborhood. Yep. Yeah.
It's also part of the beat, right?
It's part of the beat, and but they have a food truck thing there every Tuesday. So I mean, it was well timed for an all candidates meet. It was really was an all candidates meet. It wasn't necessarily a debate. What they did is they had the four major party candidates there. So they had Sly, Ray, Aggie, and Mike. They all got 15 minutes. They had up to 10 minutes to make a statement, and then it was Q&A. But some of them took more Q&A than made a statement, and that was fine. And so. Ray was the last person, Ray Ferraro, PC candidate, was the last person to have his turn. And one of the questions somebody asked him was, did he regret that Christine Elliott is not the leader of the PC party? And he said, yes, he did. so it's, he went on about talking, there's a lot of things happening at once here, but you might have, the CBC called me earlier about they had talked to the Ray Ferraro campaign about his statement that I recorded on Politico, and they said that it was taken out of context. Now, I will read for you what I wrote about it on Guelph Politico. Ferraro was asked if he had any regrets about Christine Elliott losing the PC leadership after he praised the candidate retreat she led in London a few weeks ago. Yes, he said. As a matter of fact, when they came to me to run, I thought they were crazy. It looked like a comedy of errors. And that was him describing the leadership race, or the leadership convention back in March.
It's not exactly putting a vote of confidence in yourself either, eh? It's like, Ray, would you like to run? Oh, this is crazy. What do they want me to run for?
I mean, it could be seen as self-effacing, but Ferraro did his part blaming, quote, Mr. Brown and his lieutenant, unquote, for changing PC bylaws, quote, parachuting candidates into ridings and misplacing funding. But the party has owned up to those mistakes. Having said that, quote, I was embarrassed to say the least, unquote, Ferraro added. They have not denied. I mean, that's pretty good context, I would think. But they did not deny those comments. People know that they said those comments because people were kind of taken aback at the honesty. And actually, he's been getting a lot of praise online. People reading that in Press Progress going, wow, his candor is refreshing. Hmm. So one would think he might run with it. But the CBC called the Ferraro campaign and said that this was sour grapes because he wouldn't come on the show. And what I'll say to everybody listening, what I said to CBC when they called me today, that I was more disappointed that he wouldn't come on the show than mad.
Yeah, because some of the listeners might not know that this is the slot we had allocated for Ray.
Yeah.
And that's not to say that we wanted to turn it into sort of beat on Ray fest, but all of this stuff has happened coincidentally, and it's trying to be spun into like, well, these people, Adam in particular, are bitter because Ray's not going to come, but that's not the case at all. In fact, you pretty much extended every opportunity to Ray.
Yes.
Probably more so than any of the eight candidates, I should add. There was like a week open, and you were in effect saying, you can talk to me anytime. We can pre-record it. You don't have to go in the studio with Hertz whatever your rationale is. Not wanting to come to the campus community alternative radio stations might not be the most friendly, but I mean, we've extended the offer to everybody, and I would say we've been fair. I haven't heard otherwise somebody saying, man, that was the worst experience of my life.
No. Blah, everyone's blah, blah. Left here laughing.
Everyone's left here laughing, and that's fine, because our job, at least I see our job, and I think you do too, is not to just beat on people. But when you're snubbed for no apparent reason, and I had mentioned that this had happened before with Marty Burke and the robocall era, that there's something about, and we realize that they're busy. I mean, Sly Castaldi came in here and
she was exhausted.
She's been like at 10 events today or something. And I heard her and some others on CBC this morning, quarter after six, when I get up,
for work. And it's like, and I understand that completely. But, you know, he didn't have to come in live. And that's what's disappointing, is that we extend every conceivable opportunity to say, please come on our show. You get a free half hour.
Yeah.
For everyone. We give it to everybody. And it's like, no, I'm not going
to. Yeah, and my point was, like, you know, we're completionists. We want to make sure, we want to have everybody.
We collect them all.
Like, we're not, like, the Three Willows thing was, like, the four main party candidates. And I think that's one of the big things we have to look at going forward in town. When we're having these all candidates debates that turn out to be not all candidates debates, the two debates that were held today, the one that CJOY did at WarMem and the one in the Arboretum with the Seniors Association, those were the four main party candidates, which is only half the candidates.
Yeah.
We wanted to give everyone the same 30 minutes to do an open format. We're the only venue. I'll toot our horn. We're the only venue that does long-form interviews with local newsmakers. Mm. The only one.
Yeah, and pretty much, right? We're not into sound bites, really. I mean, we have used them and do have them, and they sort of...
Well, we've played scrums and things we've done with politicians. Yeah. I could have played the scrum from Andrew.
But even that's longer than the 10-second thing, right?
Right.
But that's, and also, I mean, under our mandate here as a campus community station, beyond just our show, we're not even really obligated to talk to the main four if we just wanted to speak to fringe people, because that's... Essentially, what we do, we're here to provide the opinion or insight that isn't being covered, whether it is, as you say, long form interviews with all candidates or all of the players or mm-hmm. an interesting sort of something else that might be going on that isn't necessarily in the news. I mean, and obviously this is all over the news, but as you said, I mean, we are it.
Yeah.
No one sits down for a half an hour. I mean, it's significant. Yeah. And it's free. There's no obligation. We're not, we haven't beat on anybody.
Yeah.
We might be a little bit now, but
but like, just I want to let people into the process, because I don't want people to think that, you know, we're just like, you know,
we might sound a little bit defensive,
lefty,
I guess, but it's like, you need to know
lefty jerks, you know, who wanted to beat on this old man for half an hour. It's like, no, we want, you know, and I've said this to a lot of people, that I think our Gloria Kovac interview from the 2015 federal election is probably one of our best interviews, if not one the best interview.
And I think she was surprised too when she came. There's this, sometimes
she left
this,
laughing.
Sometimes there's this reticence. Some people are like, is this live? So how is this going to go? Because we never ever give anybody a tip off as to what we're going to ask them.
No.
So, and if they've never heard us, so they don't know necessarily what we do. Although I think people have a pretty good handle what you do because of all the other venues, let's say, or, you know, your blog, etc. I mean, I might be the wild card of the bunch, but I don't think I've never overstepped. I don't think so anyway. So,
but I mean, we're pretty open and available. Like,
open
our website, our website lists who we are and where we've come from
no
and what
secrets,
we do.
It's right.
Radical
activists.
When the writ was drawn up, respect to Steve Pagan. When the writ was drawn up, we sent out emails to all the campaigns we knew about. And there were a couple of campaigns we didn't yet know about until like a couple of days after the campaign started. But we sent out emails to everyone and said, this is what we're doing. These are the Thursdays. These are the time slots. You know, pick what works best for you. But be advised, it's first come, first serve. And the conservatives got that email too. And when the slots filled up, I sent a reminder email to his campaign manager, Ray Ferraro's campaign manager, said, okay, these are the two slots, or the three slots that are yet to be filled. And he's like, well, none of those work. And I was like, okay, well, you know what? Given the circumstances, we want to make sure we get everybody. Why don't you pick a time that works good for Ray and your campaign schedule? We'll take 25 minutes. You drop by CFRU. We'll record something, and then we can just play it.
And that was wide open, too. I saw the chain of emails. It was like any time.
It was any time. And then I didn't get an answer back. So like, it was about a week or 2 weeks later. I called the campaign manager. I called the campaign office. I got the campaign manager on the phone. And I said, I hadn't heard back to you. And he's like, well, like, the next week's going to be like really busy. I was like,
no kidding.
I was like, I understand that. But like, I'm opening. I have a big, wide, open availability that I'm offering you. Could choose a time and come in. And it was around that point I said, you know what? If you even just want to meet at the campaign office, I will come to you. I will bring a recorder and come to you, because we do not want to let the election go by without our listeners hearing from the PC candidate. That's not fair to them. That's not fair to you.
And yet. And I don't think we've ever done that for anybody else. I don't think.
We didn't have to, though.
No, well, that's the thing. I mean, it's...
We're able to squeeze people in. We can make it work. We're, like, you know, we're not we're not calling the shots. We recognize we're a community radio station, and you know, we're busy people, too. You have a full-time job. I have a part-time job and on top of my full-time job.
I come here
job.
Straight from the job.
Right. So it's, you know, we realize we're in a busy world with busy people, and we're trying to make every accommodation we can. Having said that, we try to make every accommodation. And let me just add this one more thing, that if we wanted to get revenge on all the people who were unavailable to come on this show or didn't want to come on the show, or, you know, even in my case with the Guelph Politicast, we'd be busy. We'd make a full-time job out of revenge. It's crazy. You know,
and
there are a couple of city councilors who I won't name just out of respect who we haven't been able to finagle into coming on the show yet. That's fine. That's their choice. We would prefer to give every city councilor an opportunity to come on and have a chat, but not all of them can, or not all of them have the time, or not all of them want to. They should, but they don't. So this idea that, you know, I'm out to get revenge on Ray by publishing, by hanging him with his own words, basically, it's not right.
Yeah, and what we prefer is no runaround. If you don't want to come, just say no. Don't get us a well. No humming and a hawing and all that. And even if you wanted to say it's because you're a bunch of whatever... But of course, we would use that as ammunition. I would prefer that. And, you know, a little bit of honesty goes a long way. It's like, I know you could argue during the year. I would say, if you're going to argue not coming to this show during the year, it'd be like, I can't find a damn parking space, right?
Yeah.
But right now, it's crickets out in the parking lot. There's wild animals. Anyway, we've got a little bit of time left, 10 minutes left. We're going to do a quick... My God, we're going to jam all this stuff in like eight minutes. What happened? Tell like the auctioneer and we can get everything in. No. You were at a lot of events beyond Three Willows.
Yeah, Andrew Horvath was here on Monday.
Yes. Did you go? I did go.
Yeah, it was fun.
Did you have a beer?
No, I'm not going to have a beer at lunchtime. I mean, there were people.
It's very professional.
There were people who were, and that's fine. No disrespect. But, you know, noon is.
It was hot.
Noon is too early for me.
The people are hot and sweaty.
But yeah, it was hot and sweaty in there. It was a cramped setting. I mean, between
it was a full house too, though, from what I saw. Right?
Full house between people who were interested in seeing Andrea, and I think there was more interest than actually, there's a lot of interest when even the NDP leader comes to town. So I wouldn't go that far, but because things look so good for her polling wise,
plus
the local media, plus the provincial media. Like the people who are on the campaign
everything.
Bus.
Monday's a bit of a slow day. And
yeah, it was jam-packed.
Was it the proletariat chariot, they call it, or something? That broke down? That's a whole other story.
I saw that online. But I think that was yesterday or Tuesday, but it wasn't Monday. Everything kind of went off according to schedule Monday.
Now, do you think, and I don't think, are we going to see Doug Ford in town? Even if it's somewhere on the perimeter?
No.
Even down in Puss Lynch or something, Guelph Wellington, he's just, we're not on the radar, are we? It's so close. I mean, he manages to go to northern Ontario. He manages to go to the southwestern Ontario to a farm way down yonder. But yet, we're so close and yet he's not coming.
I mean,
do you think there's some hidden tensions there beyond Ray's comments yesterday in terms of why he's not coming to the hood?
I don't even know, because I'm not even sure it's about the local candidate, because I was talking to some of the provincial guys who were on the Horvath campaign bus, and they're talking about going to Ford events where it's kind of the Ford show, and the local candidate is sometimes not even there. And that happened today.
Wow.
He went to London. Andrew Lawton wasn't there.
Oh.
But of course, Andrew Lawton's kind of a lightning rod. But there are...
That guy, when he opens his mouth, it's all bad from what I can see, right?
But
at least in the past.
There are Ford campaign stops, though, where maybe the candidate is there, but it's all about Doug Ford and whatever announcement he's there to make.
To his friends.
Friends.
Formerly folks. Folk friends. My friends. I wonder,
did you hear? Well, I mean, that's the thing. He's been well-trained to not do the folks.
So he's trainable, which is good. And it was heartening, actually, to see earlier in the week, a little bit, when he sort of revealed the people that would be his cabinet
on election.
Yeah. And you look at that on the one hand and say, oh, yeah, right. You know, you're running the assumption that these people are going to be elected. But of course, we saw Carolyn Mulroney in that bunch, Christine Elliott.
Vic Fedeli.
Vic Fedeli, the gang. You have to hope that he would rely on that. Because, I mean, regardless of what Ford thinks or whatever, we don't have the American system in that we have the sort of presidential premier, which I think is how he's playing it.
Yeah.
He's just going to do whatever. I'm going to do this and this and this.
Right.
But at least if he has something of a committee, and including Christine Elliott, which would probably make Ray Ferraro happy, I was going to say it might not be so bad, but I don't know. What is bad to me, and to a lot of people is going right now, is the lack of – now, supposedly they've released – I didn't see it – released policy of some kind.
Yeah.
It's more like a list of promises. It's not policy. And if I've got it right, there's no costing.
Yeah.
When is the costing going to come? Like Wednesday at 5 or something? Then you can make up your mind as to whether the people – I've never heard of this. I mean, I know it's unique circumstances and that they couldn't put out the policy document with Patrick Brown's face on it. And he turned up earlier this week, too. It's like, what are you doing, dude? What? He just appeared. I didn't even listen
David
to
David Peterson turned up at an Andrea Horvath stop in Stratford.
What?
So it's, you know.
As
it's,
a pro?
It's,
or as a,
no,
just
I just
to sort
he
of
was
hang
there.
Out,
he was just hanging
heckle.
There. I think he's on
I
one
was
of,
premier and you weren't.
He was on one, I think he's on one of the boards there. I don't. It was just weird. Suddenly David Peterson is there.
But he was only premier thanks to the NDP, so maybe he owes him one, right?
Well, perhaps.
Realistically.
But you raise an interesting point about Doug Ford, because I think my biggest concern about Ford has yet to be resolved, which is, like, I'm not 100% sure he wants to be in government. I don't think it's what he wants to do, which is why...
Trump.
Well, yes.
His hero.
But the thing with opinion. He prioritized... What was the Monday announcement? Here's what my cabinet's going to be, instead of... Here's this platform that we fully costed and vetted, or at least somewhat costed and vetted, or at least explain how we intend to pay for it, even if that explanation isn't just like, when we get in, we're going to cut regs, cut tax, and then growth is going to explode, which means we're going to have all this extra money, which is basically what he was talking about in the debate. But yeah, he's prioritizing the show. He's prioritizing the people. That's kind of what he does. And my thinking is, if it is an NDP victory and he's going to have to be the official opposition leader and roll up the question period every day to ask questions, and they have to be in order because there is rules of decorum, he can't just go up there and go, my friends, such and such and such and such. And, you know, there has to be, like, there's a format to that and a tradition to that. He can just go up there and let his belly rumble, as my father would have said.
If that's the case, he'll be gone in 6 months. I would guarantee that.
Well, that's the thing, though, but that's not fair to the Tories.
No, it's not fair,
not fair to their supporters. And if Doug Ford is in it just to be premier, I think that should be a consideration.
Well, I said that the nonpartisan gloves would come off for a bit. I'm going to take them off for about 30 seconds. This is just my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
My problem with Doug Ford is everything, is the whole package. I think the guy doesn't really give a crap, like you say. We get hints of that. It's just my way or the highway kind of stuff. Do you run government like a business, or do you run it? Like I said, thankfully there's a team there. Maybe that's a ray of hope that was not intentional, by the way. But I just, the whole thing is problematic. The big one being that there is no platform. He potentially become the premier of the province with no costing, no anything. Just like, we're going to do this.
Buck a beer.
Yeah, the buck a beer thing. And the Simpsons parallels, the memes are so accurate. Dental plan, or we're going to give you a keg of beer. I mean, that's what he's playing on, right? And the gas is going to be cheaper, and your taxes are going to be cheaper, and da-da-da-da-da, mono means one. Like, forget it, buddy. Forget
it. It's so
and
funny.
And that's nonpartisan gloves back on.
It's so funny. I still hear, whenever I hear anyone say the words dental plan, the first thing I think of is
goodness.
Lisa needs braces.
Yes.
And I was just listening to somebody today talk about dental plan, and the first thing that popped in my head, and I almost said it out loud, Lisa needs braces.
They've predicted everything. So,
I mean, that's all right. That'll have to be the last word of the campaign. We will be back next Thursday at 8 p.m. We are skipping the regular show next Thursday at 5 p.m.
Because
we'll
be
filling. Be
here till the bitter end.
Right? There will be fill-in programming on next Thursday at 5 p.m. And at 8 p.m. you can tune in here for Ontario Election Infinity. Identity War, which is our election night coverage starting at 8 p.m. And Scotty and I will be here, and Christopher Curry will be here crunching the numbers. And to learn more about the show or to listen to the Canon interviews again, you can go to opensourcesguelph.com, find us on social media at Open Sources Newswire, or go to @OS_Guelph on Twitter. And you can find the podcast on the Guelph Politicast channel on Podbean, or subscribe through iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play. You can find me on Twitter at Adam A. Donaldson, or go to guelphpolitico.blogspot.ca.
Scotty Hertz on Facebook, Scotty Hertz on Twitter, and I blog at spannerbook.wordpress.com.
And DJ Sounds Good to Me is next here at the top of the hour on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio, and we will see you next Thursday at 8 p.m. for Ontario Election Infinity War, and we will see you then.
Don't you dare miss it.